Good day, and welcome to Holland Village. Today's date is 9/04/2002. This session is The Emergence of God in Space and Time. Your presenter is Michael Horn, MD. Let's listen in.
We've got personal space, we've got the container.
There's a question here.
What was that?
A question here.
Hold on a second.
Or come.
No problem.
Go ahead.
Your physical space,
right.
You want to feel safe in it, and for me, gravity has a great deal to do with it.
Gravity.
Because I've had a couple of falls, and all at once, that gravity isn't working the right way.
Okay.
You feel unsafe, and when you feel unsafe, I think that you're very fragile, or you don't have the stability or strength that you would to deal with something else.
So she said stability, and she equated that with the psychological term called strength. Although it is metaphorical to some extent, isn't it? But stability. So what's in it?
Well, you know, when you started the discussion about space, you know, you said we are a point.
Right.
And yet I can think of being out in space, the astronauts, where there is no up, down,
right,
forwards, backwards.
Right. So they have no what?
No point of reference.
No point of reference. What's a more sort of...
Or no center.
No center, that's one way of putting it. What's the way we talk about that? And it relates to stability. Just in our everyday speech, we say no...
Ground.
Ground, yeah. Ground. What's even simpler word than ground? She's got it. And stability. And place. And place.
Mm-hmm.
Place. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Please. And bless. And could you translate stability for us a little bit more? What might that refer to in just your ordinary language?
Well, with stability, I don't know that this is where you're trying to lead, but you're in control of your environment, or you're in control of what you're going to do or are doing.
You're in control. So that's a psychological, or somewhat metaphorical, isn't it? So when you're stable, you're in control, and we are oriented.
Yes, and I don't think you feel threatened at that point.
Oriented? What was that?
I don't think
you
would feel threatened at that point. In other words, you're...
Okay. When you're stable, you're in control. And when you're in place, you're oriented. What are some of just the ordinary metaphors? I use one in the prayer, I think. Feet on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Anything that pops into your head.
Well, you had said falling through the cracks.
That's right.
I was talking about
we're not falling.
Physically falling. But
we're not falling through the cracks. Yeah. How about getting knocked over? And we feel we've been knocked over, okay? So we can get knocked over or knocked down. That really knocked me over.
Unbalanced.
Unbalanced, exactly. That's terrific.
Oh, there we go.
Feet are on the ground. Ground is shaky under my feet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, ground is shaky, that can be...
First quarter.
Unbalance is a great one, because it's just almost totally translates into the mental, doesn't it? When we feel unbalanced, you know, we just say that, we don't even think that that's a spatial term. We don't even have to make a little translation to do that. So placement is another very important issue in space. We want to feel placed. And then when we're placed, we can then orient ourselves, you see. Okay? All right, so we're doing good. We've got placement. So what else happens in space now that we feel contained and we're placed and we're oriented?
Well, then you can start doing things.
Ah, here we go. Exactly. See, and that's totally psychological as well. We start doing things mentally, remember. But when he says doing things, it's not quite spatial. What do we use to as the equivalent for doing things?
Moving.
We get moving. What was that?
Power.
What was that?
Power.
We feel power, yeah. But we get moving, don't we? So now we get moving.
We function.
And we feel we have some power. And we do things. And that's what happens when we literally get moving, but also it happens when we get mentally moving. Because the idea is that we have to feel placed and oriented psychologically and contained before we can get mentally moving. And when we get moving, what happens when someone starts to move around and doing things? What do they begin to establish around them?
Sphere of impact.
Right. How do we translate that into something psychological?
You gain confidence.
What's that?
You kind of gain confidence.
You do gain confidence. Exactly. But what do you actually do when you're in a sphere of impact?
Influence?
Pardon?
Influence?
You influence, have influence? Yeah, that's true. Having influence? Make things happen, all those sorts of things, feel effective.
But you also bump into things.
Ah, there we go. At least that's the next step. That was the next page.
What did you say?
Bump into things.
Oh, bump into things.
All right. Okay. Did we put control here? Because we the sphere of impact or a sphere of influence, having influence, yeah. It's a sort of a control word that we, at this stage, we're in control. We refer to this as that we've got a region under our control. We've established control in a region. And can you see how these terms begin to sound a little bit like military metaphors? Like we've got control of Afghanistan, we can control that region. Israelis have got control of the West Bank and that. So this is often a region of control. It pretty much always is the region of control. It's terribly elusive. There's a world out there, we're placed, oriented, we're moving around, doing stuff, having impact, feeling power, functioning, but we're not bumping into things. Okay. So we've got ourselves. Our own region is worked out. It's all established. But now, we start to bump into things. And what's a very common expression that we meet somebody that we haven't met for a while? And we were downtown and we were shopping and we
ran into
somebody. Bumped into somebody. Yeah. Does that actually happen? We have not. We have run into or bump into that. But the word bump is what? What's it referring to? Or ran into?
Lack of control.
Lack of control, yeah. It's a surprise. Yeah. So the bumping into things is the things once we start to do things in our region, and also, of course, when we move out of our regions, we'll bump into things that we're not in control of. Mm-hmm. So we'll be in an arena where all sorts of surprises can occur.
And yeah. I can think all sorts of fears could arise.
Fears, absolutely.
Because, you know, I was trying to apply this. Now, remember, Mike, I go write the application.
Right.
Is the way I would apply this and what's happening in our world, and even going back to evil, is that the minute you step outside your space, your personal space, and you start bumping into different people, different ideas, different ways of looking at the world, I think it can be really scary.
Absolutely.
And there would be a tendency then to want to draw back into your own space
and
not deal with the other at all.
We'll keep this as personal space, right? Because this is very, very basic, this personal space up here. Now that's what we run into when we're out of the line, getting our breakfast or something, and somebody gets a little bit too close and we sort of step back a little bit. Well, we're talking to someone who want to sort of have a more intimate conversation, we step forward. So personal space is here. And what you're referring to, I think, here is this space here, and it's a region, and the other word for it is my what? My world. This is my world. Okay. Now you're hearing the term world, and this is just critical on the philosophical side of things, and postmodernist philosophy. Because we all have our worlds, and we have big worlds or little worlds. So that we'll bump into things. If we have small worlds, we'll always be bumping into something. Or we might have such tight boundaries around our world that we never bump into things. So we never venture out of our worlds. So our world is a special term because it does have special connotations. If we stay in our house all day and never leave our houses, which some people do, or stay in very, very narrow environments, never travel overseas, never even travel out of the state that we were born in, we're in a very limited geographical world, but it's also a very key psychological term. In Heidegger's philosophy, we're beings in the world. And the world is this world, the spatialized world. And it's also a time world. If we have time, we'll get into this concept of time as well. But more important in the sense of the presencing of God, I think, the spatial side of it. So this is my world, which we talk about all day and night. And remember, we have several worlds, don't we? What's our primary world, usually? The world of our
family,
right? Exactly. Yeah. And what's our next world?
Community.
Our community, right? But is our what is our community world? How's it made up? Is it actually just the town that you live in, or what?
No, it can be people, extended family. Maybe extended extension is a word. I don't
he know. Said it can be. What else could it be other than...
Well, I think we have many, many communities that we belong to. So you might have a work community, you might have a church community.
Exactly.
You have a circle of friends, and you have different circles of friends sometimes. You know, you do this with some, and some may be action-oriented, like we like to do this together, and some may just be people you want to talk with.
That's right. So you have different worlds, but worlds are made up of creatures, people. But it's also made up of symbolic things as well, of course. The furniture in your house is part of your world, remember? The things in your house, they all go to make up the living world that you're in. But the vital part of our world is people, other people. So we have a work world and a family world. And I have a psychoanalytic world, for example, because I'm a psychoanalyst. You would have a world related to particular professions that you're in. You have worlds related to your interests as well. And then we have the North American world, or we call them spheres of influence, but they're worlds, they're places in which we're placed, literally, but also placed psychologically. So region and world is synonymous, and world is the key term in this philosophical view, you see. We don't exist in a world that's actually real, even though it's spatialized. It's a psychological world. We have all sorts of spatially related experiences inside that world. everyone's looking a bit blank. It gets a bit hard. Wait till you bump into things, then he's already said. So what happens when we bump into things? We get afraid, right? Mm-hmm. So why do we get afraid when we bump into things? We bump into new people, or, you know, the worst thing that happened is 9/11. Literally something was bumped into something, but it was a massive bumping into something, wasn't it?
It bumps into assumptions.
So how does our world get structured then? Via various types of assumptions. But not just assumptions about good, bad, right and wrong. It's actually assumptions about space, the place that people should be in. This person got out of their place. We use that expression a lot, don't we? So it's both psychological and value-laden and spatial literally and psychologically spatial at the same time. Now the bumping into things is bringing a multi-dimensional world to bear on us. See, this world here, in the simple language of geometry, we call it a two-dimensional world here. Here we're in a one-dimensional world. When we're contained, we're in a one-dimensional world. We actually have a world before this. We'll put it a zero world. Let's see if you can get the zero world. When are you in the zero world?
When you're in your own mind?
Asleep?
You're in the womb?
No, not asleep, because you've got to be conscious. And you could be, you're often in the container when you're in your own mind. Hmm. You're sitting there in your personal space, like you were this morning when we were talking. You were reading a book, and your husband was about 6 feet away from you. So you both had your personal spaces, and you were reading. And you were sitting inside that space, weren't you? And I bumped into your space a little bit as I came up to the notice board. And then you opened up your boundary, actually, and started to talk to me. Remember that? Mm-hmm. So you're sitting more inside your container, would that be okay, you think? Mm-hmm. Or were you in a, you were in your, out in the, you were in the world of Holden? Not quite. Because it takes a while, I've been here 5 days now, and I feel I'm getting into the world a little bit. Although I felt out of the world this morning when they were doing their carnival thing. I didn't feel I was part of that world. So it actually kept me sitting up on the balcony. I felt like coming down and partaking. But I thought, well, that's not my world. I'll stay in my personal space. So I stayed in my one-dimensional world. And I didn't go into the two-dimensional world of the Holden world.
Just taking the difference between an introvert and an extrovert, what an extrovert considers bumping into a space is different than what an introvert considers bumping into their space. And then, just to take the Myers-Briggs, when a person is severely judging and they've got their routine set out for the day, you've got people in their office that are very judging, and things change, they go into chaos.
Absolutely.
But when somebody's extremely perceiving, they brighten up when something goes wrong, and they fall into it, and they start taking care of the thing, and they're delighted that the thing fell apart, because so it's different for every person. You can't predict this thing unless you know the person very well, as to how they're going to take this and what is going to be their actual.
Well, this is a big question that he's asked here, and my wife tells me I must answer questions as they come up. It's a big one, because the introversion-extroversion dimension relates really to the old way of looking at space, the inside space versus the outside space, which is the traditional way of looking at space. It's having space as an object. But somehow space is out there, and I'm inside something, and I'm in internal space, and separated from external space. That's what the idea of extroversion, introversion relies upon. So it's tricky because an introverted person really is more of a person who's focused on their own inner thoughts. They like to be inside thinking and feeling, and not just thoughts, but thinking and feeling. They're interested in what's going on inside themselves. And an extroverted person, in a typical sense, is interested in other people, but not necessarily other people in a way that is intimate with other people. So they can actually be more impersonal in certain ways than introverts can be. But this dimension is interesting and useful, it has been, but it does rely, as you can see, on a geometrical aspect of space. That there's inner space where the introvert hides out of outer space, and the extrovert's in outer space, running around in outer space. Get the idea? So this is the idea of actually living inside space, neither having being in or out of space, but always inside space in certain modes in space. It's hard to get, it takes a while to get the idea. So you'll have to think about it for a while. But keep using the metaphors and you get it. So is that okay? Probably I didn't answer it satisfactorily, but...
Oh, no, no.
Okay. Bumping into things, okay? So we bump into things because they're things that disturb our assumptions and we start to feel chaos. So we get into what we might call a third dimension. And this is when worlds start to collide. We hear that expression, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Worlds are colliding. Right now we have a collision of the Muslim world, although probably not really totally the Muslim world, but we've shorthanded it that way, and the Western world. We'll have to find a better name for it, because a lot of Muslims live in the United States.
Sure.
And probably work in a, you know, several of them were killed in the, when the chaos fell.
It's the same thing with the Palestinians and the Israelis.
That's true.
I mean, there's a large Palestinian population. They're citizens of Israel.
That's right. Exactly.
You know, so
that's
some
right.
Of them are Christians.
Some of them are Christians. Exactly.
Even Lutherans.
Right. Exactly. All right. So worlds collide, and then we can reestablish one world again with more included into it. Right now we are in a stage of worlds colliding with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
There's no expansion yet.
Ah, boy, what did you have for breakfast?
He could read his mind.
Expansion. So my world got bigger. Remember that phrase? My world got bigger. And what do we do when we make our world bigger? We take something in, right?
Right. And assimilate it.
Remember last night? What did we take in? The
shadow,
right. So these worlds that collide, the shadow collides. So we're getting now into the different metaphorical arena of the shadow. The shadow, as you can see, is a much more unliving metaphor in a certain sense, although it's a metaphor that's interesting because we go into the darkness, we feel we've gone into the darkness. And here we're getting some of the things I was talking about. We got the darkness last night, and we split off the darkness from the light, right? And now, here we've got the nothingness. We're incorporating the nothingness. Because if it's outside our region, we only really know our world. Remember, it was the boundary out there which we can't go beyond. Remember? You know, we live in Europe in the 16th century, or the 14th century perhaps, and Australia and the United States are not in our world. There isn't a world. Remember, they used to draw the atlas of just Europe. So we have to expand our world. So we're dealing now with the nothing, or the totally alien to our world, but nothing because it's not a space that we acknowledge as part of our world, you see.
Here be dragons.
What was that?
Here be dragons.
Here be dragons. Dragon
put on the map. And
that's right. Remember the dragons.
And yet, you know, there's a dragon. Yeah.
Big teeth, right?
But
there are more like the bird, right? There we go.
There are also people who thrive on the unknown.
That's true. Exactly. People do. So we'll see what that psychology might be in a sec. So the world's got bigger now as we've been able to incorporate the unknown. And we can see that the spatial way of thinking about it actually is very helpful in terms of things like post-colonialism and things like land rights for Native Americans. There's a huge land rights movement occurring in the Australia right now with the Aboriginal people. And that the actually getting the land is also being included in the world. It's a sort of a concretization of this idea of spatiality. Get the idea? So there's an enormous amount of writing now about geography as it relates to psychology.
Yeah, because the Aborigines kind of feel they're in a void.
So we're now getting down to the void. And the Aborigines are in the void. Not only are they in the void, but they're dark as well. They're much darker than the African Americans. They're very, very dark people. Just black, almost totally black. They're just a fabulous looking group of people. So here we can expand our worlds because we bump into things and we include things in our world. Like, you know, 50 years ago, the Germans were definitely not part of our world. But now Germany is our ally. You know, Germany's now going to supply troops to attack Iraq. Their current election, the two parties that had a different view on that Germany should provide troops to attack Iraq. But God, you know, 50 years ago, we were, being beaten.
Well, there. Just look at the British and the Americans.
That's true. The British, exactly. Yeah. So the final space that we can be in is the void. Well, let's go back. Sorry, this we didn't get that first space. You were in your contained space, but you're in a container. But let's see, when we're in a space where nothing mental's occurring and yet we're awake.
What about if you're totally dependent and assimilated by someone else?
True, right, exactly.
Or meditation.
So you're sort of, how would you talk about that spatially?
The womb?
No, you actually got to be conscious. But you're totally dependent, what did you say, totally dependent?
And assimilated.
Assimilated by another person. What's another way you could say that in a spatial way? Those two people are like peas in a pod, stuck together, inseparable.
Joined at the hip.
Joined at the hip. There we go.
No wonder English is hard to learn.
Now, they're joined at the hip. And what about their mental activity, the two people that are joined at the hip? What's their... What are those two people like when you meet them?
They're like each other.
Exactly. They have a unified mind. They have one mind. They're joined at the hip. So that we call this in psychology adhesive identification, that you're actually stuck up, velcroed up against another person. And this is the basis of autism in children, or psychological autism, where the children actually stick themselves up against objects. And they don't actually have any type of creative thought at all. And they don't relate to other people as creatures, they relate to them as objects. So this is the more common or garden form of what we call adhesive identification, the joined at the hip people. Like a couple that literally go everywhere. You know, they do their shopping together and they go everywhere. You see them downtown, they're always together. But they're also just of one mind. I've got it, of one mind. That's the mental side of it. Okay? And this is the zero dimension. what we call adhesive identification. And this place is often a place we're in when we wake up, when there's a little bit of mentation going on, or when we're daydreaming and we're very tired. And we're just trying to get our feet on the ground. We've just got out of bed. We're trying to get our feet on the ground. Sometimes what we do is we stay in bed and we pull the blankets up to our chin or even over our head. Because we're not ready to begin the day. We're not ready to get moving. Okay. So in a normal person, this unmentalized state or very, very low mentalized state is a sort of a precursor to beginning to get your feet on the ground and feel your container, get oriented and get moving into your world. But you're certainly not ready for worlds colliding at this stage.
What about the experience in contemplative prayer where, you know, you're feeling all one?
Right, right. Well, you see, we're going to try to link these up in a minute.
Yeah.
But these states actually have some similarities. Because this is a state that children are often in. If I have time, I'll give you some of the infant observation material that I use when I'm giving this to a professional audience. And you'll see how my little kid moves through these stages. I think we'll have time to do that. So children are often in these states, this zero-dimensional state. And it is when we're feeling good about being in our bed with our blankets pulled up to our chin, often all sorts of interesting thoughts, but they're very self-referential thoughts, occur to us. It's unmentalized, and yet sometimes lots of interesting things are occurring. So it has relationships to meditative states and states of fusion with the divine. So God appears in this state and in this state too. And often this is where mystics get, one religion's group of mystics go in this category and another group goes in this category. And this is sometimes more of a lightness category, and this is more of a darkness category. So this is a more of a St. John of the Cross mysticism down here. And this would be a more of an Augustinian mysticism up at this point. Is everyone okay with that? Okay, how about the void? I talked about the void in the prayer. What about the void? Nobody's ever experienced that, right? You're all too grounded, right?
Yeah, right. But, you know, but even from science point of view, even the void, there are particles there.
Uh-huh. Now, his breakfast wearing off now because he's gone back to...
Oh, shut up.
But it's a bit like the introversion extroversion. That goes back to the scientific explanation, which is the objective. It's not the lived in explanation, because the void, of course, is just space as it is. It's our experience of space.
Well, the mystics and John of the Cross in particular talk about the dark night of the soul.
Right. So what's happening with the dark night of the soul?
I haven't got there yet. But it's it's like a feeling of emptiness and
nothingness.
Yeah.
Nothingness?
Godlessness.
Right.
Without boundaries.
Godlessness.
Overwhelmed.
God's absent. Overwhelmed. Okay.
Sometimes called fear.
Fear, exactly. There we go. Okay. So what's happening here in this state in terms of all these guys up here, containment, place and orientation in my world, even my bigger world with things that I can tolerate bumping into? What's happened to...
There's no experience, there's no...
Right, so if there isn't experience, what's missed, what's collapsing? What does the experience...
Ego.
Our friend the ego. Because these are all things about our friend the ego, yeah? Aren't they? Here, this is why this is a somewhat of a mystical state, because there's not much ego up here. But from here down to here, we have our ego organization. So here's where we have our collapse of the ego, and this is why so many mystical practices involve various ways of collapsing the ego. And of course, in our own spiritual growth, just in our everyday spiritual development, we are looking at the ego, because so much of what Jesus is talking about is destabilizing and deconstructing the ego. Just take up my cross and follow me, or take up your cross, but it's really taking up his cross. Even just as simple a statement as that is getting rid of this, isn't it? So here's a state where we've lost our moorings, okay? So we can be a boat here, or we can be a kite, so we can fly off, or we can go on a journey on the water, or we lose our moorings to the earth and we can fall through the cracks. So often sort of stories about fairy tales and various mythological stories about the void, the person goes on a journey and loses their moorings. Loses the moorings from their familiar places. And it's much worse than worlds colliding, because when the person goes on the mythological journey, worlds do collide. You know, they go to the land of this and the land of that and the land of the other. But here is always the complete sort of disappearance of any type of stability. So often holes open up in the ground, or the hero gets whisked off the top of a mountain or something like that. So this is a very important place where God emerges. God emerges, of course, in the worlds colliding. God's world collides here, but this is a very deep and profound and life-changing experience here of the world, the God just appearing as God's manifestation. And God appears here as meaning. God doesn't just walk in, here I am. God appears here as his meaningful transformations. Often God will appear as an image here, or a very, very deep and disturbing experience. God will appear out of the midst of that in some meaningful form. Or God will appear here in something that just comes into our minds, sort of a statement or a point of view or something like that, out of this feeling of total collapse and disturbance. So it's a very important place to be able to enter and maintain. And then, of course, as I said before, this mystical state and this mystical state have lots of similarities. But God's got to have room, you see, to appear. And that was what we were talking about with the breakdown and the breakthrough the other night. Now, I don't have any slides, but I do have some pictures. And I first started to sort of really get hit by this whole idea when I was visiting the University of British Columbia Museum, if anybody's ever been there.
Yes.
Native American Museum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you see these fantastic totems just emerging. They seem to be coming out of the ground. And then I went to the Japanese garden nearby, and they have these beautifully flat lawn areas, and then they have objects emerging out of the lawn. And you see, what I thought this was sort of moving between these two dimensions, or more in this dimension. And we're in a sort of a simple two-dimensional world, and then something just emerges suddenly. And I think this is the basis of the totemic representations of God, what we call aniconic. They're not icons like the pictures that are painted by the Greek Orthodox Eastern Christian peoples. But they're just sudden emergences from the flatness, usually. I think Stonehenge is like this. Mm-hmm. But this little rock in the Japanese garden, suddenly I thought, wow, that's what it is. Comes out of, changes dimensions, and there we go. Now this one's a painting by Jackson Pollock, who's the American abstract expressionist painter, who painted drip paintings, if you've ever seen those. And they're usually covered all over. The whole space is covered. But this is one of the paintings he did very late in his life. He was an alcoholic, and I think ego was very deconstructed, partly by his alcoholism. But here's, I think, an interesting painting of the void. It's not nearly as good in the little card as it is in reality. It's in the Pompidou Museum in Paris, if you get to Paris. But that's the void. But if you notice, you know, when you're out walking or something like that, and you'll see a flat area and a stone, and it sort of rivets your attention and can be very moving. And these totem poles were the genuine article totem poles in the museum. And it's a very quiet atmosphere, isn't it? And it's usually foggy and sort of mist everywhere.
Yes.
So I've got 10 minutes, and I'll just do 5 minutes with the examples of the little child, and then we can do some questions. But you can see how evil ties in with this too, because evil often is seen as being in the void. The devil hides in the void. Evil things will happen to us when we drop into a void. But actually a void's an opportunity, because it's really that God's in the void. And getting back to our idea of the shadow is also an opportunity, like we were talking about last night. So that what we think of evil is actually an opportunity for transformation. So it occurs in the spatial metaphor and in the metaphor of the shadow as well. And then the third thing that I talked about in the cosmogonies gets split up, that's very important, is chaos. So chaos is very vital. It's the chaos of the ego's concept of itself. So chaos is important to be able to enter voids and to search in the shadow. So just with a little kid, to give you a concrete example of this. This was several observations. Infant observation is a new form of research in psychoanalysis. It's a naturalistic form of research where the observer is usually a trained therapist or analyst, but not necessarily teachers are now doing infant observation. And you get with a normal family, if they'll let you do it. And
you
can find one. You can find one. It took me a while. It took me 6 months to find it. And you come to the house once a week, and you're just a fly on the wall. You don't take notes, you take your notes afterwards when you get in your car, but you're just a fly on the wall. And you observe the infant in relationship with the parents, and you don't intervene, you don't do anything. You know, sometimes the infant will look like they're falling over, and of course you're just there, sort of waiting to grab them, but 9 times out of 10 they don't. So it's a very undisturbed type of observation. And the purpose of this is to sort of see infants in their naturalistic setting. But it's not just a research tool, and I'm using it partly as that, but it's also a training tool for therapists to be able to contain their own anxieties, their own fantasies, their own inner disturbance in relation to what this little baby's doing. Because this little baby becomes a projection of your own inner baby. So it's a wonderful training tool as well as a fabulous research tool. So from the research point of view, my little infant, I think she was about 1 and a half at this stage. And this pretty much always happened every time she woke up, and that's why I started to get the idea that it's a pretty natural state for adults as well. And this is one morning, Saturday morning, and she's sitting on her high chair, and Daddy's having breakfast, and he's eating a bagel, and he's cut up a bagel for the little girl. And the little girl picks up the bagel, and she put half the bagel, and she puts it all in her mouth.
Like this.
And set her up.
Like what?
And then she's just going this. With the bagel in her mouth, sort of saliva coming down. She's not chewing it, it's just sitting there in her mouth. And she does this for about 2 or 3 minutes. And she looks at me, and she's completely blank as she looks at me. And she knows me, and knows I'm friendly and related to me. And then she does this with her finger, like that, several times. She pushes her finger onto the table. And then she takes the bagel out, and she gets down from the chair, and then she goes to the chalkboard. We don't have much room, I try. And she just does this all along the chalkboard, like that. Just again and again and again. And she makes a sort of an amorphous shape like that. And then she looks, gets back from the shape, and then she does this. She starts to draw a container around the shape. And here we get, she's moved from an adhesive state where the bagel's just stuck to her lips and then her fingers just stuck to the table. And then she does another adhesive maneuver here, zero dimension. But then she steps, apprehends this object, and then she puts it in a container. So then she's begun to be contained herself. And she moves out into the living room, and she hides down behind the couch. She just goes down behind the couch, and she's there for about 4 or 5 minutes. So she's again in her container, in her own space, and she's getting herself a little placed and a little oriented. And then she pops up from behind the container and smiles at me. This is the first time. So now we've moved into two dimensions here. She's got a little bit of a my world, a little bit of a region that's evolved. And then she does this several times, and she walks down the hallway, and she turns around and she comes back at me and she goes hippity-hop, like this. And then her sister suddenly pops up. So another world is colliding a little bit here, and she's getting a little bit into the third dimension world here. And the sister says, "You're a bunny," and she starts to laugh. And then she turns around and she goes back and she does bunny hops up to me several times. So she's got a little bit into this world here at this point, but you can see how she's moved gradually through into this state, and then she can maintain herself in this state for a little while. Of course, in observation, she'll sometimes go back here into these sorts of states, especially if her world gets really colliding with her older sisters. They can collide in really terrible ways. And then this, the last observation was when she was a little bit older, and she's about 3, I think, at this stage. And this was in the evening. And the observation had been going for a while, and she started to do a dance. And she was swirling around the room, dancing. And she was a little bit aware of me, not really very aware of me. And she was in her own space, and placed and oriented even though she was moving. But she really wasn't aware, she hadn't moved into any type of regional interaction with me. She was still inside a container. And then she'd throw herself onto the couch several times. And then the last time she threw herself on the couch, she turned over towards me and she laughed. And so we were starting to get into this space here. And then she said, "Do you want to see what my mummy has done?" So mummy then emerged in. So mummy's world came in. And she took me over to the mantelpiece, and she pointed at a tapestry that mummy had made. And then she pointed down at the floor and she said, "Watch out! There's a needle down there." And there was a needle sticking out of a bag which had yarn in it. And so she was able to see something quite this bad or dangerous or something which normally she would be in collision with, but she was able to actually incorporate that into a world, what we call a bad object in psychology. So she was in a state of fairly complicated world creation at that point. And then she went over to a child's, what do we call it, child recipe book, really. It's recipes, but they've got beautiful pictures in the recipes, so that the child can see the cookie or the whatever, the chocolate thing or whatever that's going to be made. And she said, "Let's make cookies." And so we went over to the couch and we slowly opened the, she opened the pages. And she'd look at them, and look at them, and look at them, like this. And then suddenly, she looked at one and she said, "That one, the pink cookies." So we were going to make the pink cookies. I had to leave at that point. But the pink cookie is a completely new thing that emerges. It was evening, actually. There weren't many lights on in the house. It was dusk. And the dancing was very beautiful. She's a beautiful little dancer. And then going through these beautiful pictures of the cookies and the chocolates and all these things, and then suddenly this beautiful picture of this pink cookie sort of emerged. And this is the idea of the void, that emergence will occur from the void. Something will just come out at you. So that the void isn't always a state of fear or panic or disturbance or chaos. A chaos in a sense that you really feel you've lost your bearings. It's a state where just something new can manifest itself. I was in my infant observer state, trying to just be egoless as much as I could, because I wanted to help it, you know. Let's make this one. The pink cookie was the emergent object from this void place, a beautiful new object that emerged, and then she would make the pink cookies, and subsequently she made them with mummy. And something new, vital, and spiritual in a certain sense, or numinous, what we call numinous, with a sort of a vitality and a luminous, it sort of looked like it was a light shone out of these pink cookies. So these experiences occurring all the time, like children are having spiritual experiences, you know, every moment virtually. If they're allowed to, of course. If there are kids that have to stay in containment all the time, of course, never get to these types of experiences, never get their worlds complex, and never get this opening in the world that something completely different can emerge. So, that's it for today. We're over time.